The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Thanks to Dwight Falk for filling in yesterday during the busy summer educational program, 2.5-3 weeks that we have going on here. We had quite a few people respond to his program, lots of interesting spellings of his last name, but they all enjoyed the program very much yesterday, so we appreciate him subbing in on the program. As I say, we're right in the midst of a busy, busy summer educational program. It's going by too fast, though. As I said to the campers yesterday, there's not many days left, and we certainly don't want to see it come to an end, but all good things do come to an end. They're going to certainly be equipped with a lot of exciting education, information, skills, all kinds of things that we've been dwelling on this summer educational program. So they're going home with a lot, and we're excited for them. We're excited for their parents, their families, and hopefully they'll be coming back to Edmond for a youth program. A couple of comments before we get into the news of today. And by the way, I'll be getting into some instruction that we gave to them last week on John Adams, the second president of the United States. We've given some clips before from the historian David McCullough. He's the one that wrote the perhaps the best known biography on John Adams. And so we'll have some clips from him and also some instruction or some good history lessons later on in today's show. This one here says, thank you for such a wonderful history lesson on George Washington. This is in reference to Monday's show. Such character cannot be readily found in these dark days. Thank you so much for this wonderful, inspiring show. God bless you all. Another one here says, most American and British leaders have completely lost their core values. And then this one here, in response to President Trump's speech from Mount Rushmore a couple weeks ago, it says, I was impressed by President Trump's speech. He showed an understanding of the situation. America has been thrust into that a situation that America has been thrust into, sorry. It says, we have entered the great tribulations. I got anxious when the city started to burn. I thought this was it. We're dying. But it seems God is tempering our national punishments. My thought is he is calling the Laodiceans, especially, to repentance. I'm fully aware of God's warnings, and I acknowledge it. So he certainly brings up, For people in God's church, they're very familiar with the seventh era of the Church of God, which is characterized by lukewarmness, spiritual lukewarmness. And so there's lots and lots of people of God that have fallen away from the truth in these last days. And hopefully the events of this particular calendar year will shake them, will stir them to action. Well, the rioting has died down. He mentions the city's burning, but there still are some hot spots around the country, and lots of violence, lots of shootings in Chicago, in Minneapolis, in New York City, in Portland, Oregon. There just is a continuing riots going on day in and day out. It's been going on for a number of weeks. There was an article by Andrew McCarthy. We quote him quite often on this program. But he talks in his article about how that President Trump needs to send in law enforcement, federal agents, to calm these situations down. He has a constitutional duty to do so, says Andy McCarthy. You can look at this first clip one, the Portland the rioters storming this federal courthouse and cheering after they push back law enforcement. It's just crazy scenes. And all these city leaders, all of these state leaders, they're far left Democrats, and they're basically saying to the president, don't send in help. Don't send in law enforcement. Just let this run its course. It really is, in so many ways, it really is a civil war. It's already here. You have the one side that says, hey, we don't want any law enforcement. And then the other side that's saying, we've got to get this under control. There's another clip two here, that shows this soldier being beaten in the streets by these Antifa thugs. It's going on in Portland right now. President Trump says he wants to get control of it. Here's a little bit from that article by Andy McCarthy. It says, he quotes the Constitution, he shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed. The Constitution says that's the president's job. But we're not hearing much about that from the chattering classes. Instead, they're saying, get out. If the president does send in the National Guard or whoever, you have city and state officials saying, get out. We don't want you here. If anything, the mayor of Chicago says, if anything, you need to pass some gun control legislation. That's the problem. We've got to get rid of guns. We've got to get rid of guns. Don't send in the police to take care of these thugs that are shooting up the place. They hate President Trump more than they hate these violent agitators that are destroying their cities. Listen to the governor of Oregon telling, she's basically telling federal troops to go home. Clip three.
So there's absolutely no question that the protests were calming down and that the presence of federal troops here, Trump's troops here on the streets of Portland, has substantially exacerbated an already challenging situation. When I spoke to the Secretary of Homeland Security last week, I told them to go home, that their forces are not needed here, they are not wanted here, and they're making a challenging situation worse. As I said, the violence is absolutely unacceptable. We're talking about outliers in terms of protesters. But in Oregon, you know, we solve problems by sitting down. We solve problems by de-escalating a situation and engaging in dialogue.
Right, we solve the problems by just chatting, by talking with the thugs, with the rioters. And meanwhile, you saw the scenes, and it's been going on night after night after night. In Chicago yesterday, you can see some footage from this shooting at a funeral. This is clip four. I think 15 people were injured or shot during this shooting, and I believe the funeral was for someone that was killed by gang violence in Chicago. So then they have the funeral for the victim, and they can't even escape gunfire at the funeral, of all things. And then you have the mayor of Chicago, 14 wounded. She tweets out, this is Lori Lightfoot, she despises President Trump. Gang violence shootings, they are skyrocketing, especially since the riots earlier this summer. And she tweets out, under no circumstances will I allow Donald Trump's troops to come to Chicago and to terrorize our residents. So the troops are terrorizing the residents of Chicago, not the gang members. They've got their talking points down. They're calling them Donald Trump's troops. You heard it from the governor of Oregon. And here's the tweet from the Chicago mayor. Just a shame. These leaders ought to be ashamed of what's happening in their cities. At the breakdown in leadership. Defund the police? I saw one black resident of South Chicago on TV saying, it's like Baghdad here. Send in the troops. He's telling the president, send in the troops. We need the troops just to restore order to our city. And yet they've politicized this. The local leaders, everything's politicized. Where is the love and the care and the concern just for the ordinary citizens of the city that need help? You know all about it. Every week, a three-year-old, a seven-year-old being shot dead by a drive-by shooting. This mayor of Chicago, she has lost control of the city. And the police, they're not allowed to do their jobs. If the president sends in federal troops, the National Guard, she says, get out. You're terrorizing us. That's the cities of America today. Illinois has had a negative population growth for 10 years. People are leaving. Why would you want to live there? The population continues to shrink. Democrats have run the city for years, decades, in fact. Shooting violence, gang violence. It's on the increase now. Well, because the police are being handcuffed. And so all the crooks, all the villains, they're just running the city, basically. Minneapolis, where so much of the rioting started, they're about to say goodbye to 20% of their police force, 800 officers retiring, moving on. That's another city that has absolutely zero enthusiasm for enforcing the law. Troops, police, you go home. You're the problem. You're terrorizing the city. And you feel for these citizens of the city, these poor people. If they don't have the police to protect them, what do they have? Well, they're going to be taking matters into their own hands. Everyone's going to be buying guns. That's what they're doing right now. The other story, I think Dwight covered some of this yesterday. The coronavirus, the second wave. Someone sent me this headline from the Daily Mail. UK records 110 coronavirus victims as daily death toll continues to fall, and figures show three times more people are now dying of the flu and pneumonia. So no one's dying of COVID-19. It's just plummeted in the UK. They're still requiring the masks and all those things, and no one's going to the athletic engagements at all. But what an odd headline. Now that coronavirus flus or deaths are down, people are dying of flu and pneumonia, which has been the case, well, throughout history. People die. In the United States, it's 8,000 or 9,000 people every day. They're dying of something. And it's the same in the UK. And yet, look at the way the media try to frame these stories. There was a headline, I think from AP or AFP yesterday, coronavirus taking off in rural U.S. state of Idaho. Look out, Idaho. It's spreading. People are dying. You remember the headlines from, South Dakota, North Dakota, a few weeks ago? The meat plant, I guess it was. They used to be really concerned about the deaths. Now the deaths aren't happening like they used to, so they're just talking about the rate of infection. And now Idaho. Idaho is, you better look out if you live in Idaho, because it is spreading. Anything and everything to keep the story alive, to keep the story going. This is from the Federalist yesterday. It says, herd immunity is exactly what the spike in cases indicates is developing, and we need it to continue. You don't hear this in the mainstream. It says, politicians have been reimposing and maintaining lockdowns and mask mandates due to media furor over spikes in coronavirus cases. This has happened in 21 states and many more localities, says the New York Times. One of the many problems with this is that the nation needs people to keep getting coronavirus. This is how you build up the herd immunity, the article brings out. It says that's because coronavirus spread is a natural vaccine that protects those who survive, which is the vast majority. We now know this. We now know that the vast majority of people who get this virus survive it. You don't hear this on the mainstream coverage either. It says, and even those who don't catch it through herd immunity, it says this natural vaccine is our only antidote to the virus until a manufactured vaccine can be made. So, I mean, this is the way of the world. They're looking for the vaccine. And as this article brings out, even the vaccines, when those, not everyone, of course, gets the shot, but the fact that a lot of people do, that helps to build up the herd immunity. And so the point of this article at the Federalist is that, look, most of the people getting it now, they're not dying. So we need this. We need this so that we can get past this. But that's not the way that the media are approaching the story. They're trying to scare people. They're trying to shut down the economy. They're trying to hurt the president of the United States with this. There was an article at Geopolitical Futures, by the way, comparing today to the 1930s, 1938, to be precise. And it says here, indeed, the 2008 financial crisis may have started the turn toward nationalism and isolationism, but the current pandemic has accelerated it, creating a climate that prioritizes state imperatives over all else and calls into question the reliability of international institutions. So it's each nation, this article brings out, looking out for its own. This rise of nationalism, the 2008 financial crisis, it started that turn toward nationalism, but now you certainly see it all the more so with this this pandemic. One last article here from I think this is from the War Room website. It just has an article here about The Last Lion, the three-book series, I guess William Manchester wrote the first two volumes, and then he had some help because he died before he could finish the third one. In any event, there's quite a lot that this article brings out about this classic biography. We've focused quite a lot on great leaders, and we've even told the campers at this youth camp about biographies that would be great to read if they could squeeze it into their schedule, but maybe I can spend a little bit more time on this article tomorrow or at a later time so that we could flesh it out just a little bit more. I want to save as much time as I can, though, for our study into the life of John Adams. We'll get to that when we come back. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Could anything be more mysterious than the question of the unseen spirit world? Angelic beings have always been a mystery to people on the earth. Do angels actually exist? Is there, in fact, a Satan, the devil? Is Satan a literal, immortal being? Did God create a devil? To understand more about the mystery of angels and evil spirits, be sure to request Herbert W. Armstrong's masterful work, Mystery of the Ages. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily.
Quite a lot of statues have come down this summer of rioting in the city near you. But one thing that you haven't heard is a statue of John Adams. At least I haven't. I haven't heard of a statue of John Adams coming down. But as I was telling the campers last week, that's probably because there aren't that many statues of John Adams to begin with. And there should be. There should be. I think it was 15 years ago, there was a group, some organization in the D.C. area that was trying to get funding so that they could build a statue or a monument honoring John Adams. But they, as it turns out, they couldn't get the funding for it, so it never did go through. So you've got the famous Jefferson Memorial in Washington, D.C. Of course, there's the Lincoln Memorial. There's the Washington Monument. But there should be a statue of John Adams somewhere, because this man was right at the center of the activity in 1776. There's a famous painting in Congress, the Rotunda Room, I believe. John Trumbull, who painted this gathering, the Declaration of Independence signing. And you've got John Adams, really, the one right at the center of this painting. He, as Jefferson said about Adams, he moved us from our seats. We hear so much about the founders who owned slaves. John Adams never owned a slave. He never had a slave throughout his life. He detested the practice of slavery, slave trafficking. He hated it. He wanted to do away with it. This first clip by David McCullough, the historian, he's talking here about how that John Adams was the driving force of that movement to declare independence, to fight for independence back in the 1770s. Here's David McCullough from a speech he gave in 2001. This is clip 5.
John Adams in the Trumbull painting stands there as the Colossus of Independence, as Jefferson called him. Jefferson said, "His sense and thought moved us from our seats. He was the driving force that drove, that pushed the Declaration of Independence through the Congress, made it happen when it happened, and that was crucial. No other figure in the Congress played such a part, as almost all who were there attest in letters, diaries, and later recollections. He gave his greatest speech, the speech which won the Congress over to voting for the Declaration of Independence, behind closed doors, and no copies, no record of it was kept, as was the policy. So we don't know exactly what he said. But he spoke for 2 hours, and he made history."
2 hours, and he made history. I think McCullough writes in his book that there were some individuals that missed the speech because they came late, and so they asked him to give it again, and he did. They have no written record of it. But he moved people. He was the driving force. He was the Colossus of Independence. In the words of Thomas Jefferson, pretty amazing. In the biography, John Adams, McCullough writes, "Few Americans ever achieved so much of such value and consequence to their country in so little time. Above all, with his sense of urgency and unrelenting drive, Adams made the Declaration of Independence happen when it did." It says, had it come later, the course of events could have gone very differently. Jefferson said that Adams' power of thought and expression, it moved us from our seats. It stirred them to action. We've talked a fair bit at this camp about taking this instruction and acting on it, being a doer of the word, not just a hearer only. Those debates in the first few days of July, 1776, as they were, in the case of Adams, he was trying to move these representatives to come together so that they could all be unified in signing this declaration. This is really riveting history when you think of it, because it's the fulfillment of promises God made to Abraham. Ephraim and Manasseh. Manasseh, of course, at that time was breaking free from Ephraim in fulfillment of prophecy. He moved us from our seats. You think of that verse in Luke 24 and verse 32. Once Christ was gone, the disciples said, "Did not our heart burn within us while he talked with us by the way?" Jesus moved the disciples from their seats, so to speak. He inspired them to action. We have a stir to action speech in the Spokesman Club training that we have at the college and in God's church. You have to be able to inspire people to act. That's what a good speaker does. Stir them to action. Move them from their seats. That was John Adams. It says, what John Adams said, this is during that debate in May and June of 1776, or the debates, plural. What John Adams said was not recorded, but as the constant battler on the floor, with all that he had written, his work on committees, his relentless energy, industry, and unyielding determination, he had emerged a leader like no other. And when the breakthrough came, at last, on Wednesday, May 15th, it was his victory more than anyone's in Congress. When they all came together, when they all were in agreement, this was thanks to John Adams more than anyone else. His passion, his energy, his eloquence. He spoke with energy. He spoke with fire. He spoke with courage. This is from Abigail, his wife. She wrote during that critical period, "You cannot be, I know, nor do I wish to see you, an inactive spectator. We have too many high-sounding words and too few actions that correspond with them. You can't just be a spectator observing these events. You've got to make things happen. You've got to go forward." Listen to this from David McCullough. Again, this is from his speech in 2001, clip 6.
John Adams was also, I have to stress, the principal figure of the Revolution to travel farther in the service of his country and at enormous risk and difficulty than any other single person. He left his wife, his children, his farm, His profession. He had very little income. He was not a wealthy man, and Abigail had to take care of the children, run the farm, do the washing, the cooking with the help of a hired girl, educate the children because schools were closed, make ends meet, and keep up his spirits.
Sacrifices, in other words, both of them, the husband, the wife, the mother. Abigail Adams wrote to her husband, saying, "I wonder if future generations will ever know what we sacrificed for them." You don't hear this message on the streets of Portland. The sacrifices made for Americans for the nation. McCullough said that when they pledged their lives and fortunes and sacred honor on that document, that wasn't just rhetoric. That was literally true. They really sacrificed. And God has called upon us to be a living sacrifice. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, wrote the Apostle Paul, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice. A living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service. That's Romans 12 and verse 1. Paul says we've got to present our bodies as a sacrifice. That's what service is in so many ways. It's sacrificing for others. That's true service. 1 Peter 2:5 says that we're spiritual sacrifices. Paul said that in 1 Corinthians that we've been bought with a price. Consider the sacrifice made for us, whether you look at it spiritually or with our own nation. Abigail wondering, will future generations know just how much was sacrificed for them? This is from John Adams, a letter he wrote to his wife as the news of the Declaration had spread, the Declaration of Independence. He said, "It is the will of heaven that the two countries should be sundered forever. It's God's will that Ephraim and Manasseh break apart." If only he knew what was actually happening then. A fulfillment of prophecy. Adam says, it may be the will of heaven that America will suffer calamities, still more wasting and distresses, yet more dreadful. It says, if this is to be the case, it will have a good effect, at least. It will inspire us with many virtues, which we have not, and correct many errors, follies, and vices, which threaten to disturb, dishonor, and destroy us. It says, the furnace of affliction produces refinements in states as well as individuals. We need this trial as a nation. We need it individually. This will help to refine our character. This will help to strengthen us as a people. Think about what the Bible says regarding the fiery trial. Verse 2 here in Romans 12, it says, and be not conformed to this world, but be you transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. Don't conform to this world. Don't be like this world. Come out of the world and revolve your life around God. Bring God into the center of your marriage, your family, your community, your church. It says here, I am well aware of the toil and blood. This is John Adams writing to his wife. Well aware of the toil and blood and treasure that it will cost us to maintain this declaration and to support and defend these states. Yet through all the gloom, I can see rays of ravishing light and glory. I can see that the end is worth more than all the means. What a positive view of this trying time. This trying time, this fiery trial. He says to his wife, there's going to be more toil and blood, I know, but it's worth it. It's worth it what we're fighting for. Following the resolution, John Adams wrote to his wife and said that America's independence would be celebrated by succeeding generations as the great anniversary festival. He was talking about July 4th. He said it ought to be commemorated as the day of deliverance by solemn acts of devotion to God Almighty. It ought to be solemnized with pomp and parade, with shows, games, sports, guns, bells, bonfires, and illuminations from one end of this continent to the other from this time forward forevermore. This is a day that's going to be celebrated from now on, July 4th. And he was right about that. All the way through to this year. And then we start hearing this new refrain that, well, it's racist. Well, Mount Rushmore, why would you give a speech at Mount Rushmore? Why would you celebrate your nation's founding? This is from Abigail Adams to her husband. She said, regarding the revolution, I have no anxiety at the large armament designed against us. The remarkable impositions of heaven in our favor cannot be too gratefully acknowledged. It says, he who fed the Israelites in the wilderness, who clothes the lilies of the field, and who feeds the young ravens when they cry, will not forsake a people engaged in so righteous a cause if we remember his loving kindness. In other words, God will protect us. God will provide for us. God will deliver us. In this next clip, this is from David McCullough's speech in 2001. Here's what he says about how religious this family was. Clip 7.
Among other things, John Adams and Abigail were devoutly, deeply religious people. The separation of church and state is a great theme and an important theme. But any idea that church and state were separated in the hearts or minds of the founders is erroneous and highly misleading. And Adams is a very vivid case in point. They were devout people.
Devout, he says, deeply, deeply religious. You think about the character of some of these founding fathers. You think about how zealous they were, how passionate they were, as I said earlier, about John Adams stirring people to action. And then the sacrifices that they made. They spent years apart, these two. John and his wife, they loved each other deeply. This is why we have so many letters between John and Abigail, because they were apart from each other for years at a time. Many, many months they were away from each other, writing these tender and affectionate letters. The work ethic, the courage, the passion, the humor, all of it. These were balanced individuals. These were God-fearing individuals. They didn't understand all of God's truth and purpose, but they studied their Bibles. They were men and women of faith. To some extent, they really trusted in God, as you heard from that letter that Abigail wrote. She said, look, I know there's trials and tests ahead, but he's going to take care of us. Here's David McCullough again, this next clip, number 8, I think it is, talking about this extraordinary family. Clip 8.
Adams founded, among other things, a great family. That's been said by Congressman Romer, but truly extraordinary family, brilliant family, dazzling is an entirely proper word. And the old fellow knew it. He knew it.
That's David McCullough saying that Adams knew he had a special family. And you look at John Quincy Adams, one of the best educated presidents we've ever had. It is a remarkable family when you look at it. I read this this psalm or this verse in Psalm 45, verse 16. It says, "Instead of thy fathers, shall be your children, whom you mayest make princes in all the earth." I read this to the campers last week. The legacy that we have in so many ways is our children, the oncoming generation. God, after all, is a family. It's a family empire. It's a family legacy that we're building. In the Key of David booklet, my father said, we must continually remind our young people that they are God's princes and princesses of the earth. They must be taught and encouraged to uphold that royal standard. Act like God's royalty today. They must be taught. They must be encouraged. They must be trained. That's been the theme of this camp for our young people. In training for rulership. They're in training to rule. They're in training to lead. They're going to be governing cities like Chicago and Minneapolis and Portland. They're going to be presiding over states like New York and California, Oregon. This world needs, it desperately needs new leadership. This is what another biographer said about John Quincy Adams and his parents. It says, what is clear in any case is that both John and Abigail poured themselves into the raising of their eldest son, and that he dutifully, indeed reverently, absorbed their lessons and their example. He became what they wished him to be. So the parents were preparing him. The parents were teaching him. He became what they wanted him to be. It says both John and Abigail regarded the upbringing of children as a sacred and solemn obligation. They took it seriously. They raised their children. How many of these thugs in the streets today have parents like this? How many are taking their education as seriously as John Quincy took his? How many love their fathers like John Quincy loved his? It says Abigail and John would have recoiled at the idea that intellect could be taught in the absence of morality, for they believed that the goal of education was to produce both goodness and usefulness. So you needed the intellect, but you also needed the morality. You also needed the character, in other words. Character and competence. You need both. You need godly character, and you need to educate yourself. You need to become good at something. You need to develop skills. Character and competence. Verse 17 in this psalm, Psalm 45, it says, I will make your name to be remembered in all generations. Therefore shall the people praise you forever and ever. That's the legacy. That's the lesson we want to get across to our young people, our children, that they are in training, that they are the princes and princesses of tomorrow. In McCullough's book, there's a section where, and I've played some of this before, but there's a section where it talks about how Abigail and John were debating about whether or not John Quincy should cross the Atlantic with John, with the father. It says here, she would remain at home. So I guess she was wondering if she should go as well. She would remain at home. And keep in mind, a voyage across the Atlantic at that time, it took 5 or 6 weeks. And a lot of times there was sickness and disease or pirates or, you know, there were dangers, in other words. It says she would remain home, but 10-year-old Johnny was to go with his father, as the boy ardently wished. So he really wanted to go with his dad. He thought it would be an adventure. It was the chance of a lifetime for him, an experience of inestimable value. Abigail recognized, her thousand fears notwithstanding. Assuredly, he would encounter temptation, she wrote. But to exclude him from temptation would be to exclude him from the world in which he was to live. It says later in a long letter written after he had gone, she would assure him he was ever in her heart, but tell him also what was expected of him in his obligation to society, his country, and his family. This is instruction she's giving to a 10-year-old. This is a letter that she wrote, Abigail. It says, you are in possession of a natural good understanding and of spirits unbroken by adversity and untamed with care. Improve your understanding for acquiring useful knowledge and virtue, such as will render you an ornament to society, an honor to your country, and a blessing to your parents. And remember, You are accountable to your maker for all your words and actions. This is something she wrote to her 10-year-old boy. You're going to be accountable to your maker for all your words and actions. So he goes on this voyage, and it was, as McCullough said, it was horrendous. He hated it. He came home and said, I don't ever want to go across the Atlantic again. And another opportunity arose, and he was 12 years old, I think, at the time, and both parents insisted that he go because they knew it would be good for his development and his education. And this is what she wrote to John Quincy when he was 12. McCullough recounts this in this speech in 2001. I think this is clip 9.
These are the times in which a genius would wish to live. It is not in the still calm of life that great characters are formed. The habits of a vigorous mind are formed in contending with difficulties. Great necessities call out great virtues. When a mind is raised and animated by scenes that engage the heart, then those qualities which would otherwise lay dormant wake into life and form the character of a hero and a statesman. He's 12 years old.
He was 12 years old. That was something that you would think would be written to an adult. What a time. This is a time that a genius would wish to live. What an opportunity. Our young people, our teenagers, have quite an opportunity in front of them. Galatians 4, verses 1 and 2 says, Now I say that the heir, as long as he is a child, defers nothing from a servant, though he be lord of all. It says, but is under tutors and governors until the time appointed of the father. He's under tutors and governors because he needs training, he needs instruction, but he's an heir. He's going to inherit all things from the father. We need training, we need discipline. We need instruction. But what an opportunity. What an opportunity we have in front of us. This biography on John Quincy Adams, it says the essential components of John Quincy Adams' early education were a passion for knowledge and intellectual accomplishment, an abiding Christian faith, and an extraordinary awareness of the dramatic moment in history in which he was living. He really grasped, John Quincy did, that he was living at a time that a genius would wish to live. These were the founders. These were the patriots. Another quote, it says, John Quincy Adams understood as a very young boy that his life belonged not merely to himself, but to his country and its cause. He would never forget that a life properly lived required commitment to principle, sacrifice, and suffering. This was not just a remarkable man, John Adams, I mean. This was a remarkable family, an incredible wife, children. And this legacy would continue for generations, by the way. One final clip here. This is his parents again. I believe this is a letter from Abigail Adams telling John Quincy about all the opportunities he had in front of him and how that he wanted to make the most of them, or he should make the most of them, but that he also needed to remember humility as well. Clip 10.
If you are conscious to yourself that you possess more knowledge upon some subjects than others of your standing, reflect that you have had greater opportunities of seeing the world and obtaining a knowledge of mankind than any of your contemporaries, that you have never wanted a book that has been supplied to you, that your whole time has been spent in the company of men of literature and science. How unpardonable would it have been in you to have been a blockhead?
Pardonable it would have been for you to end up as a failure or as an ignoramus. This was someone, a young boy, who was hanging out with Thomas Jefferson in France when his father was stationed there. He had opportunities to learn from masters, to learn from geniuses, and he took advantage of them. 2 Timothy 2, verses 1 and 2, it says, "You therefore, my son," this is Paul's instruction to Timothy, "be strong in the grace that is in Jesus Christ, and the things that you have heard of me among many witnesses, the same commit you to faithful men who shall be able to teach others also." We've got to establish this line of leadership. We've got to commit this truth to other men so that they can go and then teach it to others. And that's really what this summer educational program is all about, building that continuity between one generation and the next so that they can then go out and teach. We'll take a short break and we'll conclude today's program. We've got some clips. I believe we have some clips from Sunday. We've got a few emails asking about the live broadcast for our campers. And Dwight's put together a montage from that, the Sunday broadcasting class that we have. So when we come back, we'll conclude today's show with the montage. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The Armstrong College Bible Correspondence Course is a distance learning program that makes the Bible clear and understandable. The correspondence course enables enrollees to learn what the Bible itself says about subjects that affect you and the world you live in. This fascinating Bible course highlights and proves what the Bible says about morality, war, religion, terrorism, and other current events, focusing on the root causes of this world's many problems facing man, as well as their solutions. The Bible and this course also focuses on the reason mankind was created in the first place, the way to happiness, accomplishment, and fulfillment, as well as the truth behind important doctrinal questions, such as what happens after we die, the nature of God, the resurrection, the millennium, and other critical subjects. Enroll today in the Herbert W. Armstrong Bible Correspondence Course. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com.
The Trumpet Daily.
My name is Jacob Hessong, a camper at SCP from Dorm 2B, where God has blessed us with several morning thunderstorms which have provided for amazing afternoon cloud cover and temperatures 10 degrees cooler than forecasted for mid-July. I've just loved it.
At the beginning of SCP, each camper went through benchmarks which tested their abilities in activities such as softball, soccer, volleyball, basketballs, and other skills such as throwing, running, agility, and strength.
My favorite new activity at SCP this year is rugby. Like many of the girls, I'd never played it before this summer, and I think we all picked it up pretty quickly.
This year of SCP has provided many campers the opportunity to learn and experience new things. For me, I had the chance to learn a bit about leatherworking and even make a small book cover. This was something I never would have done on my own.
Here at SCP, we play a lot of different sports. One of my favorites is actually basketball, and it's very intense.
I've been to camp 4 times, and something interesting about SCP is that for the first time here at camp, all of the campers and instructors participate in Ignition, a group exercise we do every morning before breakfast. I'm Jeremiah Hostetler. You're listening to KPCG Radio.